It was a time of upheaval, of self-organization and social movements to assert women's rights, a time when the personal became the political, where gender roles were questioned, free love explored, equal pay with men demanded, and radical possibilities ventured. No, it wasn't the 1960s, but the turn of the 19th century, an era described by feminist historian Sheila Robotham in her book Dreamers of a New Day, Women Who Invented the 20th Century, published by Verso. She's a Simon Research Professor at the University of Manchester and the author of many, many books, including A Century of Women and the acclaimed biography Edward Carpenter, A Life of Liberty and Love. Sheila Robotham joins me by phone from the UK. I want to welcome you and ask you if you can start by describing for us the era in which your book is set, that is from the Belle Epoque of the 1880s until roughly the 1920s. What was going on during that era socially in the UK and the United States during a time that we might describe as a period of globalization?
Yes, my book covers the 1880s to the 1920s, and in both countries there are really dramatic changes afoot. This is an era when capital is becoming much more global. There's also, particularly in the United States, but to a lesser extent in Britain, quite a bit of movement of people, because people are flocking to the United States, obviously, from many countries. And black Americans are coming up, fleeing from the South to the North, searching for a better life, and finding that they're living in the ghettos of the big cities. In Britain, there is immigration from Poland and Russia, Jewish people coming, and also Chinese people settling. And there's an anti-immigration panic in the 1890s against the so-called yellow peril and against the Jews. So there's a lot of conflict going on around some of the changes that are occurring. And there's also marked contrast in inequality of class. There's differences, vast differences opening up in wealth in the United States as the new capitalists make vast sums. And the immigrants and the working class people are crammed into these urban areas where there's all kinds of problems opening up. So there was an awful lot of turmoil going on in this period, and women notice that this is happening, and often are concerned to help in some kind of way. Middle class women get involved in various philanthropic schemes, and some people are moving towards socialism and towards anarchism.
During this hour, we'll talk about the vast range of activities that women were involved in during this period. But I wonder if you could just give us a broad brush sense of the range of movements and activities that women were involved in, which, as you say in the book, does not necessarily conform, well, in any way, to any particular single ideology.
They range, really, from people who were concerned to reclaim prostitutes and save prostitutes, and were inspired by religious and ethical ideas, through to women who are involved in the feminist movement and are busy creating alternatives like little vegetarian cafes or places that women could actually go to be alone and independent, because simply to sit in a cafe on your own made people raise their eyebrows, and they thought, here is, you know, a woman of doubtful virtue. So to actually have a space that women could have was important. There are people coming from the factories and getting involved in the early attempts to organise women into unions in both countries. There's an attempt to reduce the hours of labour to 8 hours a day, and women are taking those ideas on for themselves and suggesting that men need to take account of the fact that women are also working in the home. So actually ideas that in the early days of the women's liberation movement we thought we'd completely discovered, they were on to already.
And there were influences, since there was such a wide range of ideas and movements, focusing for now on perhaps one of the more radical parts of the spectrum. I wonder if you could talk about the sorts of influences to people who were willing to push the boundaries much further from pre-existing 19th century utopian communities and ideas such as those of Edward Bellamy, who wrote the utopian novel Looking Backwards, or William Morris's News from Nowhere. What were the influences of ideas that posited a whole different way of existence?
One of the I think we should say that actually in the background there is the fact that there's the suffrage movement, the big movement that is really affecting, you know, lots of women in this period is suffrage in both America and Britain. But there are also women, as you say, who had ideas that of a much more dramatic transformation than simply talking about women having the vote. And the origins go back in America to those women who were around the free love circles, who were small groups campaigning over issues to do really with the complete autonomy and independence of the person. So it was a very individualist vision. They believed that every individual should have rights over their person. And from that, they went on to argue for the right to say no in marriage. They challenged the idea that the husband always had a right over the woman's body in marriage, and argued that rape could occur in marriage. And these ideas were very startling to late 19th century male-dominated vision of how women should be. And from those ideas, the anarchist and free love women went on to talk about different kinds of sexuality, different ways of experiencing pleasure, and disagreed with each other quite heartily. Some argued that sexuality was essentially male and that women were more spiritual. And others said, rubbish, this is not true. Women have their own sexual desires and should be able to express them freely. Problems did arise in free love circles because they had very ideal notions of relationships, which, of course, didn't always work out, and they didn't they didn't find that they were able to overcome always the jealousy and feelings of desire that didn't really fit the rational script. But on the other hand, they were real pioneers and incredibly brave, and they really influenced the next generation that's going to come along in the early 20th century and who start to make these ideas a bit more mainstream through literary and artistic circles in places like Greenwich Village.
I just asked you about the more radical aspects of these movements, but moving to the mainstream, you mentioned that obviously much energy was put towards women getting the right to vote, a fundamental right. What other issues and demands and forms characterized what we might think of as the more mainstream feminist, whether or not it was identified as such, movements of the time?
When women were campaigning for the vote, I think a lot of them thought that other changes would come, that it would mean an end to low pay and what was called sweated work, which was the kind of system of women working in small clothing shops or putting out work and doing it at home, and they got really bad pay. And there was a feeling that if, you know, women had the vote, they would use that to improve the social conditions of women as workers. And they also began to campaign for various forms of welfare for mothers. So in Britain, people were trying to set up maternity centres for women when they just had children, to bring the children to so they could be checked and looked after by a nurse. And they often did this on a quite an ad hoc self-help basis. So, a clinic would be set up or centre, and then they would campaign to get it funded by the local municipality. Sometimes they actually turned to the local cooperative society and they got money from that. And the co-op was quite an important place for as a way of providing services when they couldn't get municipal state funding for them.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Sheila Robotham. We're talking about her book, Dreamers of a New Day, Women Who Invented the 20th Century, which is just out from Verso Books. So I wonder if we could talk a bit more about how women during this era transformed everyday life, that they saw social constraints, mores, confining them in so many different ways, and in the process of transforming society, sought to transform their strictures on their everyday lives.
I found when I was actually writing the book that it was very difficult to know quite how to begin. It was like having a great big ball of wool. I was sort of unravelling it and trying to find where I could find a sort of beginning point, because when women got involved in social projects, like these cooperative projects, they often developed a sense of their own individual abilities, and quite a lot of working class women really realised themselves through being involved in groups like the co-op in Britain, and to a lesser extent in America, where Dana Frank has found in Seattle there was a flourishing cooperative movement which was related to the trade unions. But they didn't ever have a national organization in America. So there was this way in which women would feel that they could express themselves through getting involved in a social project. But there was also this really strong individualistic spirit, which is present both among the anarchists and the free lovers, but also the feminist and socialist inclined women who were influenced by the cultural changes that had produced what people were calling the new woman, who was the woman of the late 19th century in her shirt waister, who rode her bicycle and sat in cafes and discussed affairs of the day. There was this sense that there was a cultural transformation going on in women's individual lives. And as women took part in movements like the suffrage, they found that they were categorized as being these kind of new women. And that often created a kind of tension in their lives, because they found that they were breaking with established conventions. And that drove them outwards to question as individuals, at the same time as trying to bring about political and social changes. So it's a very dialectical interaction between the personal and the political. And they were remarkably conscious of those interactions and talked about how change was not, you know, politics wasn't just something about voting for people out there. It was about how you lived and what you could do in very everyday circumstances.
And while clearly women were on the forefront of it, at least some section, maybe forward-thinking sections of society, were engaging with this too. You have written a tremendous, if I can say that, biography of the socialist Edward Carpenter, who was influential in a whole range of different ways, and epitomized in some way some of the social change that was being hoped for by people who would be further to the radical end of the spectrum. But concerns around healthy living and exercise and one's relationship with nature, how would you see the wider movements of women and their struggles around reforming everyday life as relating to those traditions of what might be seen as utopian socialism?
Some of the women that I write about were really concerned to bring in reforms and a more regulated form of capitalism. They were worried about the incredible waste of human life in the factories, or concerned about the immorality of young women. So they were trying to really reform and regulate. But there was the wing of people who were concerned to have deeper changes, who wanted to have a much more radical kind of vision. They were extremely influenced by male thinkers as well as women. So they would be reading the famous American utopian writer Edward Bellamy, and they did read Edward Carpenter, the English socialist who wrote about women's emancipation and was an early pioneer of writing about homosexual emancipation too. So there was a way in which they would draw on men as well as women. And Walt Whitman is a great favourite both in Britain and America, because he, you know, his writing is about the freedom of the body and going off into the street and having direct relationships with everybody. And this was absolutely extraordinary to women who, you know, particularly the middle class ones, who had to go around with their gloves and parasols and tight waists.
Well, we've just been speaking about the male thinkers. What female thinkers of the time stand out particularly to you in terms of their originality and their influence?
Well, certainly in terms of influence, the one who really has a big impact in both countries is Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who herself had experienced some of the personal difficulties of being a new woman. She found herself really going crazy in her marriage, and she'd had one child, a daughter, and she became very depressed and wrote the famous book, The Yellow Wallpaper, in which she began to feel that she was merging with the wallpaper. And she left her husband, which was a very drastic thing to do in the 1890s, and lived as a woman writer, working on social issues. And like quite a few of the women of this era, were quite influenced by John Ruskin. It was not because John Ruskin had said great things about women. He was appalling about women, but his ideas about the economy as a household impressed her and other women who were interested in social change. And she also gravitated to the groups, they were called the nationalist clubs, that were set up because of Bellamy's ideas about the importance of he had this idea of state ownership, and therefore they were called, that was why they were called the nationalist clubs. She went on to write a lot about women's work and position and the economy, And she, as well as writing books about society, she also wrote novels in which she and stories in which she imagined how alternatives could be. So she had ideas about a wonderful kindergartens where the children, of course, were so happy learning through play that none of them ever wore glasses or were naughty because they had such a fulfilling time and they didn't have to read or very much. They just learned through doing.
Another thinker who you write about is the Fabian socialist Beatrice Webb, who herself struggled with defining her relationships with men vis-a-vis the importance of her own work. She represents, in many ways, more of a what we might think of now as a sort of a liberal or social democratic strain within these movements, interested in the welfare of the working class, but with some unease about, you know, open class struggle. What's your assessment of her during this time?
Well, she's not a person. I have to say that Beatrice isn't a personal favourite of mine. I've never felt personally drawn to her, but actually, she did emerge as I was writing the book as a really significant figure because she not only does she write about women and work, but she had an influence on a younger group, an interesting group of young women Fabians who cluster around the London School of Economics, and they were taking up the approach of Beatrice and her husband Sidney Webb to looking at the history of institutions like trade unions, and they're very interesting because they are beginning to go into areas that are quite new for women to start theorising about, like the economy and the history of trade unions. So she really sets an example of what's possible to do as a woman intellectual. She I think suppressed a lot of her own feelings in order to achieve the kind of autonomy that she did achieve, intellectual autonomy. And interestingly, because she is connected so much with a rather state top-down version of socialism, she did write this interesting article in 1913 in The New Statesman, in which she really talks about what she calls a wider movement of women. They call it an awakening among women, which is not confined to the suffrage, but is linked, she thinks, to the international movement of labour and also to resistance against colonialism. So it's a very wide vision of and a global vision of women's resistance being linked to these other movements, and it's quite interesting that she should observe that in 1913, because she's not really seen as a kind of new social movement theorist, Beatrice Webb.
What about women's participation during this moment of great activity and ferment in movements of the right?
Well, I kind of chickened out by not having any right-wing ones in. My dreamers are radical or reformist dreamers. They're not right-wing, but there are certainly very strong right-wing organisations of women, which mobilised women in Britain in the Conservative Party. They were quite a formidable force, and they were called the Primrose League, and they were meant to be persuading people to vote for the Conservative Party. So there were these kinds of organisations, and there are Christian and mothers organisations in the United States, which are also to the right, but some of those groups did get involved in trying to set up provision for children and for mothers who were working and things like that. So they did a few things, those women.
one of the movements that you do write about, which would be hard to say is of the left, is the temperance movement, which organized for women's around women's issues and against domestic violence, but on a very moralistic basis about restricting alcohol and so on. How do you see that movement fitting into the different movements that you do cover in this book?
Yes, temperance is a complicated one, actually, because going right back into the 19th century, there had been a temperance movement within Chartism, the working class movement for the vote in Britain, and also within radicalism. There are different elements in temperance, because it's coming sometimes from sort of aristocrats who are saying it's, you know, workers should be taken away from drink and forcibly removed from where the pubs are. But it was also sometimes a movement coming from working class groups saying, you know, and working class women saying, actually, we are very upset by the consequences of alcohol and we believe in temperance. So it's a kind of ambiguous movement. And I touch on it, but I didn't really go into temperance in great detail because of the fact that, as you say, aspects of it are quite conservative, but others did connect to ideas about social reform.
You also write about these religious movements, and your book, of course, encompasses African-American women in the United States. What sort of organizations, obviously the black churches are one institution that springs to mind, but how did black women organize themselves during the period that you're writing about?
They had very little access to any kind of even the sort of small amount of welfare provision that existed in the States, and consequently focus on self-help projects. It's a really strong element in African-American women's organizing, and they created their own social settlements. They created places for young women when they came to the city so that they could afford to live in a place where they would be safe. One amazing woman, Maggie Lena Walker, took over a friendly society and turned it into, with help by women who put in pennies, she created an enormously powerful bank, which became an African-American bank. She used the money that was made to create a department store so there could be employment for women. And she was also an early civil rights campaigner against segregation in transport long before the civil rights movement.
We'll return with my guest, Sheila Robotham, after this music break.
Have you been to work at Idris? No, we won't go in today, for we're standing by a comrade and we'll never run away. She stood bravely by the Union and she spoke up for us true. And if she gets the sack, no, we never shall go back. Whate'er they do, whate'er they do. Now you boys who wash in bottles, it really is a shame to take the place of women. Don't you think you are to blame? Come with us and join the Union. Never heed what Idris said.